A new collectibles-focused publication has just launched. We'll be speaking to its founder, Darren Revelle, later in the episode. Plus, we're looking back on the Final Four, and the hip new Brooklyn trend is owning a soccer team. It's Tuesday, April 9th. I'm Owen Poindexter, and this is Front Office Sports Today. Record-setting Final Four in the books. Our own Amanda Kristovich is joining us live from Phoenix. Welcome, Amanda.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Great to have you on. So we just got the numbers for the women's final. 18.7 million watched the final between Iowa and South Carolina. What does that number say to you?
Yeah, I mean, so that was just the average, right? 18.7 average, 24 million peak. This is the most watched basketball game, men's or women's, college or pro, since 2019, in 5 years. It beat out every single ESPN sporting event with the exception of the Olympics and football. It beat out most regular season college football, most bowl games. You know, it beat out the men's final from last year by 4 million viewers. So I think all those numbers are to say that this is the women's Final Four and women's March Madness has gone from being treated like an afterthought to, you know, despite being treated like an afterthought, has gone in 3 years to become one of the most valuable media properties in all of American sports.
You have been writing recently about how, for all the excitement around the Final Four, there was a topic that got very little discussion, even though it's going to be, you know, the big thing going forward in college sports, which is the end of amateurism.
Yeah. You know, so the men's Final Four, for those of you who don't know, is not just three games, right? It is essentially the Super Bowl for college sports. The entire industry comes here for networking, for meetings, for conventions. The National Association of Basketball Coaches is here. Media executives are here. Everybody, you know, most of the commissioners are here too, especially in Division I. So this is the place where all the big topics about the industry are discussed. And I've spoken with several sources over the weekend, and they're not talking about amateurism. They're not talking about the employee model. They're not talking about unionization. There are only two public events that I know of that were, you know, in any way, shape, or form about amateurism. And one of them was an Arizona State University Humanities Department event. It wasn't a Final Four event. It wasn't an industry event. And no one from the industry went. So, you know, I also heard that coaches are talking about an employment model, but it's like they're chit-chatting on the side and, like, you know, postulating what it could look like. They're not, you know, there's no formal proposals being drawn up and discussed. It's truly remarkable to me, and remarkable in a negative way, you know, how the most, you know, the most seismic shift in the entire industry, in the history of the entire industry, is being ignored on its biggest weekend.
And do you feel like that's because they're just not ready to acknowledge it yet? Is it still, like, are people just, you know, closing their eyes and hoping it goes away?
Yeah. So there's that. And there's two other things that I'm seeing are happening. College sports is a very reactive industry. So there's more conversation about NIL and the transfer portal than there, you know, the issue du jour, than the larger structural issue of amateurism, which, by the way, you know, unionization could fix the transfer portal. It could fix the issues with NIL, for example. And then there's another reason that a source spoke to me about, which was basically that all of the general counsels at these universities and conferences are advising their employees not to talk about amateurism, not to talk about the employment model or unionization, even in private conversations, because they could be deposed for those comments. And we've seen this happen with NCAA President Charlie Baker's Project D1 proposal, has been used against him in litigation. But that same source who I spoke with also said, hey, like, the, you know, it may be a litigation risk or a liability risk to talk about it when you're trying to fight it in court. But the reality is you, if you just stick your head in the sand and ignore it completely, ultimately, that's a much bigger risk for the industry than potentially having to sit for a deposition.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, you've been looking into, and this idea of merging the men's and women's Final Four into a single big thing, easier said than done, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've done a lot of reporting on that over the past few years. It's definitely a very logistically difficult concept, but and it's one that the NCAA has basically said they're not even going to attempt for the next decade. But, you know, this year, me being at the men's Final Four, part of that, I wrote about what I experienced and what I saw. I saw commissioners, I saw SEC Commissioner Greg Sankey flying back and forth between Cleveland and Phoenix every day for, you know, 3 days straight. I saw, I experienced having to sit in the men's pregame or pre-championship press conferences that were literally taking place during the women's championship. I watched South Carolina win the championship from my computer screen while sitting in a press conference with UConn men's basketball coach Dan Hurley. I mean, it's become untenable. It's completely untenable because of the size and the importance that the women's tournament has taken on. But we really need to come up with some sort of solution to this because it's just, like I said, completely untenable.
Check out Amanda's column on frontofusports.com, which will be out when you're listening to this. Amanda, thanks so much for joining us on the show.
Yep, thanks for having me.
March Madness is over, but we're actually extending the hat deal by just one more day. If you rate and review Front Office Sports Today on Apple Podcasts, screenshot the review and send it to me at owen@frontofficesports.com. We may send you a free Front Office Sports hat. Thanks to everyone who already has. It's been really great seeing your reviews. The Masters begins on Thursday, and one of the more charming ways that the event has held on to the past is through its food prices. The concessions menu has more than 30 items, none of which are over $6. Sandwiches cost between $1.50 and $3, coffee costs $2, a beer is $5, and if you want to splurge on a glass of white wine, that is $6. In fact, for around $60, you could purchase one of every item on the menu, and from all reports, the food is actually pretty good. The tournament also handed out Masters-branded eclipse glasses for yesterday's solar eclipse. The next one to pass through the U.S. will be in 2044, at which point you may have to pay up to $4 for a sandwich at the Masters. You know a trend has fully taken hold when it becomes the hip new thing to do in Brooklyn, and yes, apparently that includes owning a soccer team. Doing so is already popular among American investors, and now that group includes 140 people who regularly gather at a bar in Brooklyn to watch Akademisk Bold Club, the third-tier Danish soccer team which they bought a year and a half ago. While Chelsea went for over $5 billion, Akademisk was purchased for just over $1 million. Of course, the promise of a lower-tier soccer team is that with enough success, you can rise up the pyramid to become a top team and deliver a big return on the owner's investment. For instance, top-tier Danish soccer team Brøndby IF, which was purchased last year by David Blitzer, has a market cap of $422 million. However, promotion is probably not happening this year for AB. After 22 games, the club is a respectable 6th out of 12 teams, but 20 points away from the second-place team FC Roskilde, which would need to catch to move up a division. Fortunately for the team owners, this seems like it's more of a social thing, and any success on the field is a bonus. Up next, longtime listeners have heard Darren Revell on the show talking about collectibles and sports betting. He is a journalist who has spent years enmeshed in those worlds. On Monday, he launched his own media outlet, Collect, which you can check out at CLLCT.com, which is focused fully on collectibles of all kinds. I spoke to Darren on why he saw a gap in the collectibles media space, how he plans to fill it, and what's the state of the collectibles industry post-COVID boom. For disclosure purposes, Darren Revell is an investor in Front Office Sports, and our conversation is coming up next. I'm joined now by the founder of Collect, a new media source for the collectibles industry, which launched on Monday, Darren Revelle. Welcome, Darren.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you on. So what is Collect and why did you start it?
Collect is a new media company surrounding collectibles and memorabilia, kind of covering it the way ESPN.com covers sports. We want to cover memorabilia and collectibles. I think, you know, you can see through COVID that collectibles, the interest, the money that was going in was a new level. I think it became recognized as a real alt asset, and the journalism and the content didn't quite follow. There's not enough, I would say, mature content where, you know, most of it is just social media. It evaporates, and it's not necessarily smart content either. Not that what people are doing isn't right, but it's just, it's social media. It's not, I don't think it makes people better. And that's one of the things that I wanted to do. I had so many texts from people, a lot of my friends who had collected cards in the 80s and all of a sudden said, should I get my cards graded? Should I do all this? Should I, all this FAQ stuff that I wish I could point them to, because I certainly didn't have to have time in my day to to do 50 helping sessions. And so this is what this will be. It will be, you know, we'll have a should you grade a certain card? What are the standards? New type one photos, what are they? Should you invest in it? Do you, you know, how are you smart in this? So I think we bring everything to the fore in terms of covering the auctions and the dollar figures behind it. Who's buying what? What's going up? And I think I would like to think that we make our community smarter and bring them even closer together.
So yeah, it sounds like this is going to be focused on making people better collectors, more informed collectors, and yeah, creating a little bit more of a collector community. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it is definitely a wide space, and I've been surprised. I think, you know, so much has been focused on, and I shouldn't be surprised, I guess, the lottery, the gambling, the breaking open packs and seeing if you could get the big prize and win it all. And that's been probably 75% of the content. And you know, I think it doesn't intrigue me as a lifelong collector. It's not for me. And I think there's so much to be done. These stories are what makes the pieces. You know, for 10 or 15 years, I've kind of killed some of the auction houses because I've been smart about things and I've been able to buy things, I think, cheaper than they should be because the stories weren't completely told. You know, now maybe I'm on the other side. I mean, we're going to be a journalism site. It's not like I'm going to be pumping up the auction houses. But, you know, those stories can now come out if we're aware of something instead of being hidden and instead of relying on, you know, the people that are writing it up for the auctions, who are great. But there's way too many items coming out every day.
Yeah, I'm wondering how you feel Collect will interact with the collectibles industry. Like if I write about a baseball game, I don't affect that baseball game, even if I, you know, break down every pitcher's, you know, possible, you know, everything that could be coming out of hitter, they're probably not going to read my article. Whereas if you write about, you know, like we just had the anniversary of Hank Aaron breaking the home run record, if you write about the ball or the bat or the glove or whatever it was, you know, something, you know, maybe that could spark some interest and cause prices to go up. How do you feel you're going to interact?
Or go the other way. I mean, sure. Listen, I think my journalism career has been marked with having, I think people have respect for what I do, whether they like it or not. I've been very tough on people that I like. They understand it's my responsibility as a journalist. If there is something in an auction that we think isn't quite up to snuff, we'll call it out. And that might affect the prices, but that's what it is. If there's something in an auction that we think is absolutely awesome, we're going to call it out. And so, you know, I think a lot of it is just augmenting and kind of telling a play-by-play of what's going on, because a lot of this is just with just only social media, it just quickly evaporates. And I'll give you an example. So on Sunday night, Mickey Mantle's Type 1 photograph, the photograph that was used to make his 1951 Bowman card, sold for $837,000, the Type 1 photo, which is the photo from the original, one of the photos from the original negative and published shortly thereafter. People would say, and if this is just on social media, wow, I should invest in Type 1 photos. But then you go in the same auction, you see that like an unbelievable Elvis Presley photo of him combing his hair and you can see the back of his hair through the mirror goes for $615. When you're putting that in a complete story, it totally changes what people had only seen before, which is the $837,000 highlight.
Right. Maybe they're comparing that to a Mantle card or something, which could be tens of thousands of dollars.
They're comparing a Mantle card. That photo was only one 1951 Bowman card was worth more than that photo. And they're saying, maybe I should get into Type 1s. But it doesn't tell the whole picture. It's not a whole story. Then when you see that all these Type 1s sold for $500 and $700 and $800 from the 60s of Marilyn Monroe and Yoko Ono and John Lennon, it gives you more of an entire picture. And that's what we're hoping. We're hoping to paint a greater picture for the industry.
Yeah. And I saw in your announcement video, you mentioned holding the industry accountable, like, you know, not as like your sole focus, but, you know, something you're going to do. Is this an industry that are you seeing a lack of accountability?
Whenever there's opportunity, there are people that go after it, whether there's been, I mean, and this has had a long history of, this industry's had a long history of cheats, whether it's trimmers or people doing certain things to cards, authenticity, doing things to, again, the opportunity, it's thievery if you can get away with it. We've had a lot of that, this industry. And now I think, you know, there's this whole debate over cleaning cards, which is essentially taking a card using some sort of toolkit that doesn't involve agents, not adding to the card, but maybe taking a ding and figuring out how to get it out and then resubmitting it and getting a better grade. And there's debate over whether that's right and where the line is. You know, restoration in art, it's like the line at restoration. When you're restoring something, is it original anymore? And I think instead of burying these conversations or not having these conversations, we have to have these conversations. And so we will. And it might be uncomfortable for people, but it is what it is. And I think that the hobby and all of us are most healthy when we're all talking about it.
And I'm curious to get just your state of the union on the collectibles market right now. We had the COVID boom, turned out that did not do too much for my 1980s baseball cards and my 90s baseball cards, but obviously it was huge for the industry. Have things settled down since then?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the cards are down 60 to 80%. I think one of the things that I think people learned is that, at least with the modern guys, playing fantasy football or baseball or basketball with your cards is not a good practice. Just because Patrick Mahomes wins the Super Bowl does not mean your cards are going to go up. These cards, it's not all about whether the player plays well. Sometimes with Patrick Mahomes, maybe there's five Super Bowls baked into the cards, right? Maybe there's other factors, because a lot of these modern cards were held onto by kids that are 18 to 25. And frankly, they can't hold on when things go down as much as someone like a 45-year-old could. So if I'm a 45-year-old guy and I'm investing in Mahomes, I have to look around at who else is investing with me. I think COVID created this thought, especially with modern cards, that we were playing a singular game of fantasy and investing through the cards. And that just didn't turn out to be true. I continue to believe that if you get the best of the best, and your reasonings are sound, that you will do well. And I'm, you know, during COVID, my biggest mistake, I collected VHS tapes. I thought movie posters tied to an old, outdated piece of technology was a great investment, especially the ones that were sealed. And turned out, I think there were too few people in the marketplace, a bunch of pumpers, and, you know, I lost a bunch of money. But then you have to figure, why did I lose a bunch of money? So I think mistakes are made and markets crush when things are oversimplified. And that's something that we have to bear responsibility for. We have to get in there, talk about the topics, talk about the way things work, why they work. And I think people are ready for those conversations.
One thing I always wonder, especially when there's a surge around collectibles, is the ratio of basically speculators to people who actually want the item for their own collection or, you know, for whatever they want it for. I feel like a lot of the market you hear about is it's kind of the sports betting market or the people who are buying something to sell it for a higher price. And, you know, eventually you need someone who wants to buy it to buy it. Is that, you know, just a concern that you have?
It's not a concern. It just means that you have to know what you're buying and you have to try to guess at markets that have more flippers than buyers or more flippers than lovers. Because sometimes it's not even about the item. If something flips and flips and flips, like these Kobe shoes that were worn by LeBron, this was a great piece, but it flipped 3 times in 4 years. There's not anyone who held on to it. So sometimes it's not even about the pieces, but just like you have to look at population reports, you know, everyone likes the 1986 Fleer Jordan, but to me, you know, there's 324 tens and people say, oh, it's only the rookie if it's pack pulled. And that's why it's 86 Fleer. Well, I love the 1985 Interlake Jordan that was given to Boy Scouts. And PSA's graded less total of those than PSA 10's perfect 86 Fleers. I just like the scarcity of it. And I really just think that people have to pay attention. And they have to realize, again, this is a very complex game. If we try to boil it down to one or two factors on why something sells for what it does, I think it's disingenuous to the market. So something is not absolute, like this price is absolute. Maybe it went off in the middle of the day. Maybe it was in the wrong auction house. Maybe it was flipped too many times. These are complex economic situations. And it doesn't mean we should avoid them because we want simplicity and fun. We're way beyond that. I mean, this market is way beyond that. So that's the way we're going to treat it. We'll try to explain it in kind of terms that we're not offending anyone. I think we're just going to try to make people better, make this market better, keep people accountable and tell the best stories out there.
Darren Revelle, congrats on the launch and thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Get those show reviews in or at least tell a friend about the show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.